Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated. I'm your host, Claire Malky. I'm that adorable pack of seeds you were definitely going to plant. Hopeful. A quirky trait I have is that I quite literally think I can teach myself how to do anything and excel at it. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I was unemployed and I was like, you know what? Yes, I love crafts. I was hooked if it involved any sort of attention span of more than 7 seconds. I couldn't doom scroll on my phone if I was knitting a sweater. But my life was lacking. I missed basic human interactions, like sitting next to that stinky gym bro on the CTA. I needed something to literally consume all of my breath and give me absolutely nothing in return. Aha! Plants! Yes, the perfect idea. Every other quirky girl on Instagram had plants and they looked easy enough, so I was like, yeah, I can do this. Never mind that my only foray into taking care of a living thing was Miss Weaver's 5th grade science class. And let's just say my alfalfa plant didn't come home with me for Thanksgiving break. Regardless, I'm an adult now. I can take care of things. Fast forward, and I am the proud parent of a purple basil and spider plant. Tony, the basil plant. Yes, after the legendary Survivor player Tony. And the spider plant was named Boney. And yes, because it rhymes with Tony, and my roommate thought Boney was a hilarious name for a plant. I mean, he was right, but anyway. I had a great routine going. I would water them every day as I drank my morning coffee. Oh, it was so cute. I called it our little cafe. I would pretend I was somewhere in Europe drinking my espresso and that my plants were my eccentric artist friends. They would say, "Hello, Claire, how is your morning coffee? Oh, you look dashing in that beret." Oh my, Tony and Boney, you flatter me. One morning, I strolled into my little cafe, which was definitely not the stained couch cushion, and noticed that Tony and Boney weren't looking so hot. Oh, they must just be a little hungover from a night of drinking French 75s, but no, there was no "Bonjour, mademoiselle." There was something seriously wrong. My heart sank to my stomach. My intestines were in such bad knots, I had to poop. Also, it didn't help that I had just chugged my cup of instant coffee. I furiously checked the World Wide Web when I discovered that watering plants every day actually drowns them. I was gobsmacked, astonished, devastated. How could I have killed my own children? I was the 21st century Medea, and she is definitely not quirky. I took a good, hard look at my plants, and I had another aha moment. I am not a plant person. They're just not my thing. I'm still going to try zany new things because I'm an adrenaline junkie and I get a rush of endorphins when I unexpectedly excel at new things. Is there anything that you've always wanted to try? Like skiing or taking care of plants or, hey, even running for local public office? If the latter piques your interest at all, I think you might enjoy today's episode. We have an excellent show in store today. We've got our smashing headlines, our deep dive into local politics, and we'll round out the show with my interview with Chicago Alderperson for the 47th Ward, Matt Martin. In spite of everything earlier, today I'm enjoying a delightful cup of espresso. Grab your drink and let's get started. Up next, this week's headlines. The National Hurricane Center announced they won't use Greek letters for the 2020 season. Until they do at least 3 months of community service and write a public letter of apology before pledging. California researchers are tracking littered masks and gloves bound for the ocean. AKA, Californians want to tell you about their trash instead of picking it up. The cargo ship Evergreen was finally unlodged from the Suez Canal. In confusion of how the ship ended there, the captain claimed he was still in denial. It's a good thing they moved it, because the satellite images show what can happen when you use a tampon that's too small. I don't know what took them so long to move it. They could have tried so many options, like, did they try Drano? Or pushing it with the eraser side of a pencil, like if you have a bottle of wine but no opener? Did they try clenching the canal together to squeeze the ship out? Did they ask Superman to help? Did they try a really big nail file? Or what about cutting it with a hot butter knife? Or putting it on a diet? Or luring it out with a sexy ship? Or did they try a viral challenge where everyone dumps buckets of ice water on their heads? Did they try painting the canal's curbs red and putting up a no parking sign? Did they try helium? Or did they just wait around for a week while the world's economy crashed? Wow, guys, way to be the kid that gets stuck on the water slide and ruins it for everyone else. Following the Colorado and Georgia mass shootings, President Biden will explore how to tighten gun laws, causing the NRA to tighten their tender embraces of their guns at night. Fucking ammosexuals. Classmates of the Boulder mass shooter and evil Hodor, Ahmaud Elissa, say besides his terrifying outbursts of rage, he was actually a really nice person and a good guy. He's also really great at house sitting if you can see past his history of arson. A man was arrested for forcing a National Guard convoy off the road, claiming he thought there was a kidnapped woman inside the van. Come on, just admit you thought it was an ice cream truck. We all get excited for Spider-Man pops. A piece of the Wright brothers' first plane was affixed to the drone copter on the Mars Perseverance rover, to which the Martians replied, "Stop trying to make retro happen." The Pope has ordered salary cuts for cardinals to save jobs for ordinary employees. The first thing to go? Free birdseed. Man, I haven't seen this many cardinals this pissed since the Cubs won the World Series. A report by the World Health Organization says that animals are the source of the coronavirus. It's clear that WHO is attempting a cover-up by pitting the world's pets against one another. Helen the cat has not returned requests for a comment. An individual was caught attempting to smuggle 185 baby tortoises from the Galapagos in his suitcase. Officials believe the individual is linked to several shell companies. Kermit the Frog was inducted to the Library of Congress. He should feel right at home with all the other Muppets in Congress, which is the ideal location for those who prefer to speak with a hand up their butt. For his impeachment vote, Senator Mitt Romney received the JFK Profile and Courage Award. For merging properly onto the freeway, Romney will receive the Driving with Courage Medal from the DMV. The Stop the Steal crowd enacted campaigns to stop the vaccine. Followers of the far right have failed to latch onto this movement due to that one extra syllable. Prince Harry is now an exec at a Silicon Valley startup company. Because until you have one of those, are you truly a white privileged man in America? Spotify told its Manhattan employees they can work anywhere as long as they have an internet connection. They created the top 20 songs to listen to while you do anything but work. The pandemic has caused an almost permanent shift from the traditional office to remote work. Now the only morning time they spend around the brown line is when they flush it down the toilet. Good old poop joke. And that's this week's headlines. Feminism, a movement where both sides, for very different reasons, don't want it to exist. Those who struggle with the basic concepts such as tying their shoes often ask, why is feminism still a thing? I thought this gender equality was fixed in the 60s when men let their wives burn their bras. I'm going to answer that question with a few of my own. But first, I'm going to need a stiff one. First, have you heard of the pink tax? No, it's not something made up by the fictional character Elle Woods from Legally Blonde. It's real. And unlike Elle Woods, it's a total bitch. Believe it or not, women don't give a shit what color their razor is. We just want one that can take out the Amazon forest that our COVID-era leg hairs have become. Plus, recent studies show how softer color options do nothing to improve the performance of a sharp piece of metal and plastic. However, it does give razor companies a fantastic excuse to charge women more for the same product. So, if anyone asks what the pink tax is, it's the wage gap of bathrooms. Second, can you imagine if Ted Cruz bled once a month? I can. It would look like an America where tampons are free. Third, when will the laws that govern the bodies of people with ovaries be written by folks who have frickin' ovaries? This is asking the bare minimum. It's like going to a restaurant and expecting your meal to be made by an actual cook and not a group of old misogynists who know nothing about eggs. The only other way a person's right to choose could be made legal in Congress right now is if every man in the House and Senate was probed by aliens. They'd be forced to ask the tough questions. Am I ready to have an alien baby? Can I financially support an alien baby? Can I write an alien baby off as a dependent on my taxes? Does my alien baby need papers? Does it have a gender? And if so, how can I announce it in the most dangerous way possible? And I know what some of you are thinking, Jeff Sessions. Duh, that'll never happen to me. But just wait. 5 years from now, when E.T. shows up, we'll see who's got an alien in their chest and an egg on their face. And four. Don't you get me started on the ER frickin' A. Last year, Virginia's General Assembly passed the ratification of the ERA. But since they did so past the 7-year deadline that was set in the frickin' 70s, it's still apparently up for debate. So I guess my question here is, why is equality still questionable? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm as happy as the next Virginia Vag that my home state finally decided to get their shit together. But it's basic human rights, not a can of Spam that's been sitting in your grandma's pantry since 1986. So how the hell is this debate still a thing? Basic equality being questioned in the same year we put a robot on Mars is like still having the bidets versus TP debate. We all know bidets are better. Which, actually, now that I think about it, I guess my fifth and final question is, why the fuck aren't bidets standardized in the US? Come on, America! Equality and clean buttholes! That's all the women of this country are really asking for. Poof! Thanks, guys. I needed that. Up next, this week's deep dive. During the winter when the snow is piled up and you need someone to plow your street, do you know who you're going to call? No, not Ghostbusters. It's your local municipality. Throughout the last two seasons of the podcast, we focused a ton on national news and the importance of participating in countrywide issues. But what about those issues that are closer to home? Literally. Like, how is the trash removed from the dumpster? Or who's in charge of making sure there's water in the pipes? These things can and do have a direct impact on citizens' day-to-day lives. Currently, participation in local government is honestly pretty bad. According to a Portland State University study, in 10 of America's largest cities, only a little more than 15% of eligible voters cast ballots for mayors or city councilors. And the median age of those voters is 57. And voters above the age of 65 are 10 times more likely to vote in local races over the 18 to 34 demographic. Which, like, come on, Gen Z and millennials. I thought we were the ones who cared about these sorts of things. Guess we only care about TikTok dances and Zillow listings. Out of those top 10 largest cities, Chicago has the strongest local election rate at 32.67%. But, like, is 32% good? Imagine if your boyfriend only made his urine into the toilet 32% of the time. You'd congratulate him for that? Exactly. So then, how is this local participation question solvable? One major way to increase civic commitment would be to switch local elections to coincide with major election cycles. This minor switch could increase voter turnout by 29 to 37%, according to the UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. That being said, although the move sounds easy breezy cover girl, it would have to get approval from a ton of people from a bunch of different offices slash departments. Which means the likelihood of that happening is not so hot. Even though it may seem daunting, there's actually a ton of value in direct involvement in your local community. Especially because more than a quarter of all government expenditures, that's roughly more than $1 trillion, are doled out at the local level. And when turnout for local elections is low, the government spending tends to reflect the interests of the most advantaged groups of people. Rich white people. Professor Hajnal from UC San Diego suggests that if the participation of each of America's racial and ethnic groups were even, we would likely see outcomes that diverged sharply from what we see today. Change would perhaps be the most dramatic in mayoral elections, and could have ended with a different winner had turnout been even. If that's not a telling sign, I don't know what is. Now, a question you might be asking yourselves is, do local politics actually hold power? Yes. To look at the dangers of how much power they hold, we look to Robert Moses. Robert Moses was a public official for the city of New York, first charged with public works projects, and increasingly became involved with the construction of countless housing projects, parks, highways, bridges, and art facilities during the course of his 34 years in public service. Although, I'm not gonna lie, after reading this, I wasn't 100% sure that he wasn't just a villain from a Daredevil comic. He also used his knowledge of how government works, having studied political science at Yale, Oxford, and Columbia, that's some privilege, to establish an untouchable power, heavily funneling every construction project in the city through his tacit approval, and using tolls from the Bridge and Tunnel Authority to create a payroll of men who reported to him outside of his explicit responsibilities. So basically, you can thank this guy anytime you wish you could just part the Hudson to get through the Holland Tunnel. This subtle and secretive power grab he committed during his tenure under several NYC mayors resulted in one of the most successful consolidations of power by a man never elected into public office, once holding 12 appointed city positions simultaneously, without a single person ever electing him. He spent over $150 billion in taxpayer funds to create the urban planning model that has influenced every city built after his term. Robert Moses, so hot right now. Or back then. During his tenure as a public servant, few men dared challenge Moses' power consolidation, only leaving President Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the only person to directly contest Moses' right to the immense authority he possessed. Moses created highways, roads, pools, and parks for the public. But he also displaced over 250,000 people from their homes in the wake of these public projects. His efforts to build a more beautiful city often came at the expense of marginalized communities. Now you understand the importance of local politics. So let's look more thoroughly into how they actually work. I mean, when people think politics, you think of Congress and the White House, right? Throw in governors and mayors as well. But you just don't start off running for those high-level offices outright. I mean, can you imagine what it would look like if someone with no experience whatsoever decided they were going to just run for an office as important as the presidency? What a dumpster fire that campaign would look like. And if they got elected? I guess we'll just have to leave that one to imagination. But let's look at Chicago. Say there's something happening in your neighborhood that is affecting you directly and you want it addressed. What do you do? Well, step one. Contact your current reps. This is the easiest way to bring awareness to the issue at hand. In Chicago, this includes your ward representative, aka your alder person. Don't know who yours is? Don't worry, you can check it out at the City of Chicago's website. Next, let's say you've reached out, but you're hit with a dial tone. How do you notch up the heat? The next best thing is to publicly call for the action you seek from those who can make it happen. Things like letters to the editor of local newspapers, public engagement on open social media, i.e. throw some hardcore at symbols at that rep. What's the point of Twitter if not to call people out? Or go so far as to appear at public hearings and speak out on these matters. For Chicago, you can find out what meetings are available for public comment at the city clerk's website. All right, your representative is either non-responsive or hostile to your ideas or requests. What's next? Organization. Either find someone who speaks to your ideas or considering running for office yourself. Most positions, especially in local government, are part-time jobs. Wait, what? Imagine going up to someone and hearing them tell you, "Yeah, I make municipal decisions about the well-being of my neighborhood and also drive for Grubhub from 11 to 3 on Mondays and Wednesdays." I mean, hey, that could be you. The University of Chicago offers resources and workshops for those in the community who want to network and be more involved in their community. But if all of that sounds like too much pressure, like if you joined Grubhub for the allure of not having to interact with people, consider getting involved with a commission or task force. They often are created by the executive branch of your local government, such as the mayor of Chicago, to be able to get involved with your city on the topics close to your heart without long-term commitment or holding office. For example, there's a task force for pandemic recovery for the city of Chicago, and there's a number of people involved who aren't holding public office. Just Google it. To hear about what it is like holding public office, just stay tuned for our interview with Alderperson Matt Martin, who is using his bully pulpit for the betterment of the citizens he was elected by. What's up, listener? I hope you're enjoying the show so far. If you are, I am sure you know someone who would enjoy it as much as you do. If so, send it to a friend. That way you can finally have something to talk about besides the weather and if you've gotten the Fauci ouchie yet. Everyone needs a new hobby nowadays, so why not make yours writing reviews for Sit Still on Apple Podcasts? Let's be real, Joe Rogan doesn't need any more reviews. He's fine. But reviews really do help with the algorithm and help others find the show. If you want to go above and beyond, check us out on Patreon, because that's what all the cool kids are doing. Right, Anna, Jamie, Anthony, Laura, Andy, and Christina? Right. Up next, my interview with Alderperson Matt Martin. So for today's interview, we have City Council member Alderman Matt Martin. Thank you so much for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for your time. I've been really excited to do this interview, and we're so lucky that you can come on and chat with us today.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to a good conversation.
Great. So to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about your background and who you are?
Absolutely. So I am the alderperson in the 47th Ward in Chicago. That's primarily Lincoln Square, Ravenswood, and North Center, if you know the neighborhoods well. And then we've also got some bits of Uptown, Andersonville, Roscoe Village, and West Lakeview. I am not a born and bred Chicagoan. I'm from Tucson, Arizona, in southern Arizona, where the University of Arizona is located. Grew up there, lived there for 18 years before coming out to Northwestern. So the snow that we're experiencing right now, it's something that no longer is new for me, but certainly I took stock of that when I was my first few winters in the area. So growing up in Arizona, I was raised by a really tremendous single mom. My dad is from West Africa. And actually, he and my mom were introduced to one another because they both have a connection to his country. So he is from Niger in West Africa, just above Nigeria. And my mom, it just so happens, served in Peace Corps for 2 years in the late 1970s. Their paths did not cross there. And he had the opportunity to study in the United States and was given the choice of a number of schools. And he said, well, let me choose a school that's located in an area where the climate's pretty similar, because he didn't want to have anything to do with snow and lots of rain and the like. So figured out pretty quickly that Tucson was going to be a good place for him. And so a mutual friend put the two of them in touch, said, Kathleen, you've got ties to Niger. Abdullah is from Niger. We think the two of you will hit it off. And that was definitely the case. So I came around a number of years later, and my dad finished up his master's work and went back to Niger. And the plan was for my mom and I to follow him. But ultimately, that didn't come to pass. And so she raised me on her own. Our closest family members were on the coast. So it really was just the two of us. But it was like through that upbringing where I really came to appreciate the tremendous impact that community can have on you. Because even if you've got two parents or you've got a big family, I mean, it takes a village. And I think that COVID's really underscored that. I feel that personally. I've got two young kids. And so that upbringing and seeing how much love my mom had for me and how that was thankfully able to be manifested in lots of the opportunities that she wanted to help create for me, but also other folks who were also invested in me, friends, neighbors, really helped me appreciate what it means to look out for one another, to have one another's best interests in mind and think beyond yourself. Because, but for folks just taking an interest in me and taking me under their wing, I don't think I'd be here today. So I was really fortunate, came out to Northwestern, studied music and political science, and decided to go to the political science route, did law school, worked as an attorney for a number of years, including as a civil rights lawyer. And here I am now as a first-term alderperson.
That's a really amazing story. Thank you for sharing with us. You mentioned caring for your community and being a part of your community. And for our listeners who are not from the Chicago area or are a little bit unfamiliar with an alderman or a city council, can you talk a little bit about what your role is in that capacity?
Two big roles, and it's a really interesting time to be on city council in light of this. So you have the role that a lot of folks traditionally associate with an alderperson, which is a mayor of your community, mayor of your ward in a way. So you're helping quarterback issues when it comes to snow removal, garbage cans, replacing them, but also emptying them, trimming trees, repaving alleys. This isn't the case as much anymore, but previously helping make decisions about licenses and permitting that would enable new and existing businesses to operate. So you had your own little fiefdom, and in a lot of ways you controlled that, and folks would, especially back in the day when we had the original Chicago machine, you'd have patronage jobs, and in exchange for that, you'd help folks stay in office. And similarly, if you were perceived to be doing a good job when it came to coordinating those core city services, you could stay in office. What you've seen more recently, though, is a need for folks to recognize that city council is also a legislative branch. And as much as it can be important to have folks be responsive to the problems that are manifesting themselves in the wards, whether it's big or little, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, part of the solution will be changing city law or holding oversight hearings to hold folks accountable in a more public forum so that issues come up less frequently. And that's something that I think historically city council hasn't done a good job of doing. And you can look at that in a number of areas, whether it's housing, the lack of affordability, the segregation in housing across the city in more ways than one. That's in part due to older people making decisions just with their own wards in mind, and even like subcommunities within those wards in mind, without thinking more holistically about what's going to benefit the entire city. Certainly public safety and policing, the need for a consent decree in response to so many awful incidents, including the murder of Laquan McDonald. Those are situations where you see on a regular basis city council voting to approve these multi-million dollar settlements and judgments involving police misconduct, but historically not stepping up to say, hey, this is happening. Let us do a better job of overseeing and reforming the police department ourselves. Instead, too often you leave that for the mayor, whomever that person is. And regardless of how good or poorly a job you think they're doing, no one person with a city facing the challenges that we are, I think, should be responsible for creating policy, shepherding it through city council, effectuating it, and then adjusting it when problems invariably arise. You need that system of checks and balances, especially of a city of 2.7 million people. So I think it's that second component where we're starting to build some muscle memory as a city council, especially some of our newer folks. And it's going to take a little bit of time, but it's a challenge that I really welcome and that brings a lot of fulfillment along with frustration, but still lots of fulfillment.
When I first learned about older people, I always did sort of assume it was the mayor of your neighborhood. And that's sort of how I describe it to my family that's not from Chicago. But it's good to know, too, that, you know, the city council does so much more, including like police reform and things that you had just mentioned. Can you talk about what it's been like working in 2020 as, you know, a first term city council member and what this year has brought with all of that?
It was, for me, like so many folks, the most challenging year in my life, professionally and personally. And you have situations where at the outset of the pandemic, we don't even have great information just yet about how it's being transmitted. I mean, we have ideas, right? And so for a while, a lot of it was no shaking of hands, being very sensitive to workspaces, thinking that there was a real risk primarily of contamination based on surfaces. And then as our understanding evolved, with the need for sharing information in a timely and fulsome way, a transparent way, became critical. And so that was something where our office really prioritized that, working with especially the Department for Public Health in the city to get questions answered and then share that out with the community. Obviously, at the initial parts of the pandemic, significant economic stability that we're still feeling with. But I mean, we just fell over a cliff seemingly overnight. So many businesses closing, sometimes because they were mandated to, others because they could no longer afford to operate. So many folks losing their jobs and not knowing when that would improve. Because right now, with the vaccines being in existence and more available as each day passes, it's easy for a lot of folks to forget just that dread, that existential dread at the outset of the pandemic of when will life return to any semblance of normal? When will a vaccine be available? When can I go back to doing X, Y, and Z? So that was traumatic for me, just like for everybody else in more ways than one. But I was really lucky to have a job, and also to have a job that allowed me to channel some of those frustrations into more constructive ways to help get folks access to information, whether it was public health related, how to file successfully for unemployment benefits, answering questions around housing and how to stay stably housed as much as someone could, for businesses getting access to loans and grants. And then, of course, later on in the year when we transitioned to the summer following the murder of George Floyd, the civil unrest and the calls for to both acknowledge the pervasive aspect of structural racism and to move quickly and aggressively in responding to that. And so you have a pandemic coupled with real calls for transformational change and the pain that prompted those calls to begin with. It was it's a really challenging time. And I'm sure once the more significant impacts of COVID subside and I have more time and opportunity to reflect on that, I'll have additional thoughts. But it was it's hard to put into words how challenging a year it was for me. And I've still, you know, I have my health, I have my job. So I still come at it from a position of relative privilege. So we're just trying to make my way through just like everybody else.
Yeah, this year it has been really hard, even just walking up and down Lincoln, seeing Lincoln Avenue, seeing, you know, some of my favorite theaters close and, you know, some restaurants that I used to love going to that, you know, just don't have the capacity to have outdoor seating or things like that. So I definitely feel, even in my Chicago community, how even though I live in a small part of it, how it's affecting just my neighborhood. For our listeners who maybe do want to get involved or don't really know where to start, why is it important for community members to understand what's going on in their community and to get involved and get engaged?
a big reason why, and of course, this is reflective of my own job, is that voice matters. People listen to those voices, especially when they speak in concert, or at least they should. And if they're not, but they should be listening to those voices, then we have ways to help correct that. But gosh, it's so incredibly useful when I have folks reaching out to my office, letting us know what they would like us to prioritize, and especially when they can contextualize it in their own experiences. So it's not just something that's theoretical or big picture. It's this is the way in which this problem is manifesting itself in my life. So yes, please help me, but also keep a broader perspective on what could be done in more of a citywide fashion. And so for issues like environmental sustainability and justice, issues around affordable housing and police reform, ethics reform, it helps us prioritize and know and better understand the exact scope of the problems when we're hearing from residents consistently. And of course, one can do so by just calling, emailing, when it's safer to do so, swinging by our office. But when folks can work with one another to share ideas, to figure out the most effective way of sharing their perspectives in an advocacy way, I think that's all the better. And so whether it's just folks who live in the same home with one another, the same block, the same community, finding ways to talk to one another and share challenges and frustrations and hopes is a really critical way of building and strengthening existing institutions so that you can demand when necessary, work with when necessary, your elected officials and unelected officials to bring about that sort of change that in a city like Chicago, I think that there is a lot of agreement of where that North Star should be taking us.
Yeah, that's one thing that moving to a new city, it's been really interesting. I moved here about 4 years ago, but I still feel somewhat new to Chicago and meeting my neighbors and really talking with them. I haven't gotten the chance to really get to know my neighbors in COVID, and that's been something that's a little hard. Thinking about COVID and all these things in the last year that you had mentioned, are there some issues that you are really passionate about and that you are really looking to make greater change with?
A big one is housing, housing stability, housing affordability. We know that we were having an affordable housing crisis even before COVID came. The DePaul Institute for Housing Studies released a report a few years ago concluding that there's a shortage of 120,000 units of affordable housing across the city. So you start with that and you say, wow, that is huge. That is a huge deficit. And so you're talking specifically about folks who, to the extent they have income, are spending more than 30% of their income routinely on housing. And it's a problem that's gotten so, so much worse due to COVID. You see what a lot of folks refer to as that K-shaped recovery, where folks, especially folks of means, have or will bounce back somewhat quickly, and others where, to the extent there's a bounce back, it's going to take so, so long. And I think that it's really important that we use this terrible experience to remind ourselves, especially as elected officials, of the need to take really bold transformational steps to bring more affordable housing online right away. And there are lots of ways to do it. There's not a single way. So you can talk about vouchers. You can talk about legalizing, as we've done recently, the creation of basement units and coach houses. Talk about reducing the deconversion of 2 and 3 flats into single family homes. Greater subsidies for the creation of more affordable housing and deeply affordable housing. So in your larger new developments, there are just lots of tools that we need to bring to bear. And I feel fortunate to represent a community that cares about that. I don't have to fight with folks on a daily basis, just convincing them, one, that affordable housing is a need, and two, that this is what we need to do. They're pretty on board, which is great. And the second big area is police reform. So before my current job, I was a civil rights lawyer at the Illinois Attorney General's office. And that was a big reason working there why I decided to run for city council, because our office had to sue the city of Chicago to bring about police reform in the form of the federal consent decree. What happened was after the murder of Laquan McDonald's murder, the video of Laquan McDonald's murder became public, the Department of Justice under President Obama thankfully came in, as it's done with a lot of other places, Ferguson, Baltimore, for example, and did a top-to-bottom investigation and said, soup to nuts, wow, this department is in really bad shape. Training is not where it needs to be. Supervision, holding officers accountable when misconduct occurs. Technology and how we track things. Mental health resources for officers, because it's often a job where you see trauma, you experience trauma yourself. It's like we're really not doing a good job with managing our department. And typically what happens after you do that investigation, well, then you have a consent decree. What happened in this situation, though, President Trump, former President Trump, thankfully, was elected, and he instantly said, along with then Attorney General Sessions, police reform is not a need. We feel like officers are under siege, under threat, not communities. Police reform is not something we're going to pursue in any meaningful way. And so they just dropped the ball. They said, we're not moving forward with a consent decree in Chicago, period. And so Mayor Emanuel's administration was talking about doing a watered-down version of a consent decree that wasn't going to do anything, because it would still, at the end of the day, require the federal government to come in and hold them accountable. And they already said, the federal government, we're not going to do that, right? So what's the point? And so the Attorney General's office stepped in, sued the city, negotiated a consent decree, and I helped write that and do a lot of other work relating to it. And it was through that work that I got that historical perspective of city council repeatedly, routinely not stepping up to the plate when it came to reform. And so that's been a big focus of mine since being in office, working on issues both big and small around public safety, around reimagining what that can and should look like in our communities, so that we, to the best of our ability, are reducing and ultimately eliminating incidents like Laquan's murder from happening in the future.
That's a really amazing journey. And we also mourn every person who has been lost to police violence. And it's been a really interesting year to start this podcast, because we've been realizing that we just scratching the surface with people that we should be honoring and people that we need to hold up a little bit more. So thank you for, you know, speaking that into our podcast. And thank you again for your time today. We're not done with the interview yet, but I just wanted to say that and let you know. So as a legislative branch in the city council, how much sway do you all really have? And what is the process of getting something you're passionate about passed into a law for both either the city of Chicago and our local communities?
We have a tremendous amount of power as a city council. It's a strong city council model here. In practice, however, as most, if not all, of the listeners will be aware, we have a strong mayoral form of government. So as I mentioned earlier, we've got a situation where the mayor and the folks who report to whomever that person is functionally, it runs point on the big legislative issues. And one of the reasons why that's the case right now is because they have really large staff. Right now, our aldermanic offices have just enough staff, sometimes not enough staff, to just deal with the day-to-day constituent service issues, to say nothing of big legislative issues. You have city council committees that could be doing that sort of work, but they themselves are modestly staffed. So that's not always the sort of opportunity for policy creation that you see in other legislative branches, whether it's the General Assembly down in Springfield or Washington, D.C. With the Congress. So what that means is you have to be really selective in terms of what you're going to spend your time on, what you're going to lead on in particular. But the nuts and bolts of it are you introduce some sort of piece of legislation at a city council meeting. It will typically get assigned to a specific city council committee. You'll then talk with that chair to see if he or she would be amenable to having a subject matter hearing and perhaps also a vote at the end of that on the item. They'll give you some feedback about whether and when they think that might be doable. And you also need to go out and talk with colleagues to figure out where they're at with issues. If they have any questions, concerns, make sure you're answering them. And you also want to talk with the administration and potentially affected departments. And then fundamentally, and this is something that depending on the issue, you might want to actually start the legislative process with this, or maybe it's something that happens later on, which is talking with community groups and individuals who care a lot about this issue, who might be very much affected by what you're proposing, to get buy-in from them. Again, answer any questions that they have, but hopefully figure out who your supporters are going to be, because we have a big city council. I'm one of 50 folks. And so especially if it's going to be a bigger issue, it sure does help if you've got a few folks in the corner who are willing to whip votes with you, figure out where folks are. Because if I'm spending time trying to make 49 calls or then leaving a message and someone calls me back and playing phone tag, that's just really hard. But if you're working with a team, ideally another group of alders, as well as grassroots organizations, depending on the policy, that's how you can really get some good work done. It continues to be a challenge with that resource asymmetry, but I think that those lack of resources notwithstanding, myself and other first-term alders are doing a pretty good job of finding that balance and selecting a modest number of issues to really push forward with in order to hopefully affect change.
So with police form and public housing, how could residents of the city of Chicago get involved with those issues? And what are ways that they could bring those to light to maybe their community or to their older people?
Great question. I think it depends on the issue, of course, and where you live, because the answer might vary area to area. I'll speak a little bit more specifically to in and around the 47th Ward. If you're talking about police accountability, number of groups to get involved with police reform. So it can be groups like CARPERS, the group that's the leading force behind the Civilian Police Accountability Council, CPAC. You're also talking about groups like GAPA, the Grassroots Alliance for Police Accountability, which also have a civilian oversight ordinance that's being considered by city council. I think those are two great places to start. There are also organizations that have ties all across the city, whether you're talking about Good Kids, Mad City, Black Lives Matter, and BYP 100. In addition to that, from a housing standpoint, there are lots of groups who've also been focused on those challenges. So One North Side is a group that comes to mind, focused on housing, also public safety, don't get me wrong. You can look to organizations like the Lawyers Committee for Better Housing, which has done a lot of tremendous work. And then, of course, it can go down to the level of direct service providers. So in the context of housing, I mean, there are a number of homeless organizations, food pantries that are really critical. And so I would just encourage folks to figure out, okay, how far am I comfortable traveling to the extent that's a consideration, or sometimes less so in this age of Zoom and video conferencing. But still thinking about what's an institution that is doing some good work in my community and putting the bat signal out if that's needed to collect some information. And then going to volunteer, going to a meeting, just listen, learn, make some suggestions. Don't be a wallflower. And maybe most importantly, think about what resonates with you. It's something hopefully that would be a passion of yours that you would feel is very deserving of your limited amount of time and energy. So choose something that really connects with you. And offices like mine are always happy to be a sounding board to share information about any of the organizations I mentioned, as well as others, so that folks, to the extent they have the interest and time, that they can find that good match.
Yes, that sounds wonderful. For our listeners who would want to find your office or others in Chicago, how would they go about doing that?
So right now, given the continued realities of the pandemic, best way to contact us is phone or email. So phone is 773-868-4747. Email info@aldermanmartin.com. Our office is located at 4243 North Lincoln Avenue. There's a Jewel Osco that's very nearby, but you're talking about Lincoln, about a half mile north of Irving Park. Currently, the office is closed to the general public to make sure that we in the public continue to be as healthy as we can. But once COVID's more in the rearview mirror, that office will be reopened to the public.
Well, Alderman Martin, this has been a lovely interview. Thank you so much for your time and being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
And that's all for today. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you didn't hear that right, please write a review. Please, please, please write a review. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and Claire Malky. And written by myself, Claire Malky, Michael Dritto, Fee Basanyavichis, and Gabriel Scavor. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit and subscribe to our Patreon page linked in the show notes. This podcast was recorded on the land of the Kickapoo, Peoria, and Potawatomi Nations. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. Oh, and don't forget, stay opinionated. Bye!